I want to see science serve a useful purpose to improve the standard of living for all people.
Hey, why is anyone fighting food advance? A very small percentage of the world's population is fortunate enough to have the luxury of turning down food.
We've arranged a society based on science and technology. There was nobody who understands anything about science and technology.
You can't build a peaceful world on empty stomachs and human misery.
You're listening to Talking Biotech, the weekly podcast illuminating issues in agriculture and medical biotechnology. Your questions and concerns are answered using a science-based approach with the goal of driving innovation to application with communication. Now here's your host, Dr. Paul Vincelli.
Welcome to the Talking Biotech Podcast, the weekly podcast where we discuss contemporary issues in science and technology with a focus on biotechnology and new innovations that help people and the planet. I'm Paul Vincelli, sitting in for Dr. Kevin Falta, and today we're going to talk about research in biotechnology and plant improvement here at the University of the Republic in the College of Sciences. With me today is Dr. Sabina Vidal. She's an assistant professor in the Laboratory of Plant Molecular Biology. And Sabina, welcome. It's great to have you.
Thank you, Paul. Thank you for the invitation.
Sure, it's our pleasure. So first of all, maybe I'll mention to our listeners that that you and I are interacting by co-teaching a course in genetic engineering of plants here in Montevideo, Uruguay. And in fact, you gave the lecture on genome editing and did a fabulous job. So we have graduate students, some of your own graduate students, and we have other participants. How do you think that course is going so far?
I think it's very nice because there are people from different areas. There are people from working at the authorities that are controlling transgenic plants or food derived from transgenic plants. Then there are people that are students in molecular biology, and I think it's quite a nice group that have different points of view on the area, so mm-hmm. I think it's very nice.
Yeah, it's been great. In fact, today we talked about regulation, which we're going to continue later in the week, and we had some very good discussion, very good perspectives, always from a scientific standpoint, but really good discussion today. So yeah, I'm glad you're enjoying it and feel it's been useful. It has certainly been for me. So maybe a good start is always to give listeners some background in your interests generally in plant science or in science. How did you get into plant science, first of all?
By mistake, probably. Well, I'm a biologist, and like most biologists, started biology because you want to go after whales or some kind of animal. It's just like that. I had actually no interest in plants when I started. But then I got interested into molecular biology, and I started to work in a laboratory that had a project together with a department in Sweden, in Uppsala, in the Uppsala Genetics Center. And this project actually involved people from all over Latin America and then from Sweden. So I got the opportunity to go to Sweden at the beginning to.
And you were at that point. Which level?
I was finishing my career as a biologist.
So the bachelor's degree, the equivalent of the bachelor's.
Exactly. Okay. I was very young, actually. I was around 20, 21 years old. So. So I got to go to Sweden to make a short stay, and then when I was there, I was offered to do a PhD there. So This project was about plant pathology, I would say. It was in potato, and the idea was to identify some viruses that were infecting potato and inserting into the genome of potato the some virus sequences to make a resistant potato.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
It was very early. It was in 91.
Okay.
So.
Yeah.
But when I got into when I got to Sweden and then I started my PhD, I switched area because mm-hmm. that was not the main interest in the lab where I was working.
Okay, so you switched to an animal system or
No. I switched to another topic within plant molecular biology.
Okay.
I would say.
Okay. So you were hooked at that point.
Yeah.
And it just took a plant pathogen, right?
I took a bacteria this time. First started with a virus, and then I continued with a bacteria. But uh-huh. I was working from the plant side.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So that was it. I mean, I spent many years in Sweden doing my PhD,
mm-hmm.
And then I did a postdoc also in another laboratory in Sweden. I went back to potato in my postdoc,
mm-hmm.
and always with working in plant diseases.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay. Wow, I didn't know that. I know you've known a lot about plant disease.
That's my background, but I didn't continue with that.
Okay.
So, I spent many years, and I'm actually very interested in the area. And when I read something about it, I feel like I feel comfortable with the area.
Sure.
Although I didn't continue when I came back to Uruguay. Mm-hmm. I wanted to start my own research.
Yeah.
And I switched to other kind of diseases in plants, but not those that are caused by a pathogen, but by the environment.
Okay, so abiotic stresses in this case, right?
I work with abiotic stress.
Okay, and just I realized I used a term that may not be familiar to some listeners. Abiotic stresses would include the non-living causes of stress on plants, such as heat, or cold, or drought, or excessive moisture, salt, and so on. So,
I have been focusing mainly on drought.
Oh, okay.
Drought.
Okay. And you work with soybeans, or do you also work with other crops?
Nowadays, I work with soybeans. Mm-hmm. When I came back from Sweden, I worked a little bit with potato because I got a project funded by the Third World Academy of Sciences, which was very useful for me to kind of set up the laboratory here.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
And that was to work with potato.
Mm-hmm.
Then Uruguay, unfortunately, stopped being a country that can apply for funding to these kinds of agencies that fund third world countries. I mean, we are somehow considered not non-third world anymore.
Yeah.
So after that, I mean, there was basically all the possibilities of foreign funding were finished after this Third World Academy of Science, which was very useful for us.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. So you've I guess the good news is Uruguay has risen above the threshold of being a developing country, as however that's defined by whatever organization. And now that you've risen to that, and I see quality of life that I think is certainly very impressive in where I go, but the downside is that funding opportunities for science that helps in development are no longer available.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. So that's the downside. So how long have you been at the University of the Republic?
I came in the year 2000, so it's 16 years.
Okay.
Quite
okay.
a lot now.
Right. Good. And so you mentioned that you work on drought stress and mostly soybeans, I guess I understood. What tell us about your work in that area?
I started to work with soybeans in the last 5 years, I think, 5-6 years. That was because the European Union created a program that funded 5-6 years ago certain groups that would work that would create a collaboration between all the countries that that are part of the Mercosur, which the Mercosur is like I don't know how to explain.
So Brazil, Argentina, Uruguay, Paraguay?
Exactly.
Okay, so the southern countries of South America.
Southern countries, and is the economic organization for the southern countries.
Mm-hmm.
So the European Union then created this program that is called Biotech
mm-hmm.
Sur, I mean South.
Okay, South, right.
South Biotech,
mm-hmm.
it would be.
Okay. And that was the European Union, I think you said.
Yeah. Yes.
Okay.
And that was to promote collaboration in some specific issues that each country had to decide which issue should prioritize.
Be priority. Yeah.
Priority, yeah. Exactly. Mm-hmm. So they funded 5 projects that involved the 4 countries. One of them was in soybean, and the main problems of soybean in the regions are certain diseases, some of them caused specifically by some fungus.
Mm-hmm.
And on the other hand, is drought. Mm-hmm. Drought is the main cause for economic losses in the region, because the soybeans are grown during summer, and summer periods in these areas are they suffer small periods of drought, but always.
Mm, okay.
So this is not a desert area.
Right. But
these occasional drought periods are very, very harmful for mm-hmm. for this crop, because normally they occur during the stage where they are filling the grain or they are producing the grain or
mm-hmm. okay.
and everything.
Yeah.
And it's for example, last year we lost about 80% of the production of soybean due to drought.
80%.
Yes.
Wow.
We had basically nothing,
and, wow.
and what was left was all infected by fungus, because during the in the moment that the grain had to be harvested, then started the rain.
Oh, so you had molds on the grain?
We had molds on the 20% left.
Oh my gosh, yeah. So and I should point out that Uruguay is now to our, you know, Brazil and Argentina are major producers of soybean. But Uruguay is a very substantial producer as well. So this is a very important crop for Uruguay.
It's nowadays the first crop in Uruguay.
So you are doing some molecular biology work, and probably quite a bit, actually, given your knowledge. What are you doing in this area of, or have you done, in the area of drought tolerance and soybeans?
What we have done is that after this project funded by the European Union was finished, mm-hmm. we created a network within Uruguay where there are institutions like all of them are public institutions,
mm-hmm.
go back.
Okay, so we're going to go back and start again. Okay.
Okay. So what we have created nowadays is a network that is composed by several institutions. research institutions and also producers that are all working together in solving or kind of improving certain aspects of soybean breeding. So we have, for example, the main program for breeding program of soybean that is involved in this network that we created. Then we have other laboratories within the university, especially in the agronomy faculty. And also we have five national companies that produce soybean, and all of them are participating in this network that for research in soybean. So for the first time, we have access to all the genotypes of soybean that are coming out from the breeding program that we can compare. We have, for example, all the facilities for phenotyping these genotypes. Mm-hmm. And we have access to varieties that behave in a different way in specific situations. So we have varieties that are much more tolerant to drought than others.
Okay, so the variety, all varieties of soybeans.
It's all varieties of soybeans. So yeah. This has speed up a lot the research, because we can compare from the genetic point of view these varieties and find out which genes behave different between these varieties. Mm-hmm. That's what one of the things that we're doing, this transcriptomic profiling of several varieties in different conditions.
Okay.
Then we have access to the genotyping of these varieties. We are now in collaboration with INEA.
And INEA is the National Institute for Agricultural Technology, or something similar to that would be the translation.
Exactly.
So federal institution.
Yes. They are now genotyping to find molecular markers that can distinguish between these varieties. Mm-hmm. And what we have found specifically is a number of genes that we believe that they are partially involved in this drought tolerance response.
Okay.
Some of these genes, when they are expressed, they induce, for example, senescence responses in plants.
Mm-hmm.
So we found many genes that are responsible for the plant death in response to drought.
To drought, yeah.
That are activated in the susceptible varieties and are not activated in the tolerant.
Oh, okay, yeah, because you wouldn't want a crop to go to sleep and senesce and die before it's produced the grain. So I see what you've done here is identify genes that are active in the senescence response.
Yes.
And not active in the plants that are tolerant to drought.
Exactly.
Wow.
So those genes, of some of these genes, we are now testing them if they could be good targets for generating mutants there by genome editing.
Okay.
And by knocking them out, see if we improve or delay plant senescence in response to drought.
Right. Okay.
At the same time, improve drought tolerance without yield penalty.
Right, or some other loss of some quality that you
exactly.
need. Yeah. So just for the listeners to repeat, I'd like to recap some of the key points. So you've identified genes that are potentially good targets to do what you call a knockout, and some people know what that is, but for those that don't, that means you go in and make some genetic change. It could be very small genetic change to suppress the action of that gene, and see if it does, in fact, confer drought tolerance. And you also mentioned genome editing, which is, for those who may not know, it's really sort of exploded the possibilities in all branches of biology. It's a technique that's worth learning about if you haven't already. So why don't we take a break at this point? We're talking to Dr. Sabina Vidal, an assistant professor in the Laboratory of Plant Molecular Biology at the University of the Republic in Montevideo, Uruguay. And thank you all for listening to the Talking Biotech podcast.
Hi, everybody. This is Kevin Folta.
And this is Paul Vincelli.
And we're here talking about the next generation of potential opportunities with the Talking Biotech podcast.
And we have a very special invitation for you.
Okay, so here's the deal. What we're looking for is to expand the opportunities of using this vehicle to expose more people to the opportunities within science communication. How do you build your brand by potentially hosting a Talking Biotech episode?
Hosting a Talking Biotech episode accomplishes many things for me. One is I learn more about a topic that I'm interested in. And two is I develop some skills on science communication and do it in a way that's really quite friendly and interactive.
So how you do it is really simple. All you need to do is identify someone you would like to talk to, learn something about what they do, make the interview time to talk to them, and have the conversation. It's really simple. You do that, send us the audio files, and I'll take care of the rest.
And I'll offer myself to mentor somebody who wants to, stick their toe in the water and try it out.
Yeah. And in the days of standing up for science, there's no better way for you to stand up for the science you enjoy and that you would like to communicate to others than to share those important stories. And use this platform to talk about what you're interested in.
So think about it. It's a wonderful opportunity, and we're excited to extend it to you.
And now back to the Talking Biotech podcast.
And we're back on the Talking Biotech podcast with Dr. Sabina Vidal, an assistant professor of plant molecular biology at the University of the Republic in Montevideo, Uruguay. By the way, I didn't mention this before, but this is my third time in Uruguay, and I really am fond of Uruguay. The people, the food, the way they speak Spanish is quite unique, and to my ear at least. And the beso uruguayo, the Uruguayan kiss, the way you greet people is you actually give them sort of an air kiss, cheek to cheek. You know, it's just marvelously charming country. I really enjoy it.
So I noticed that you have also kind of taken some of the normal words that we use, like these bárbaro, and some of the expressions that are quite unique here and that we don't even share with the Argentinians, that they think that we are a province from Argentina, but we have some small differences.
Yeah. So maybe someday I'll be an honorary Uruguayan.
Yes, I'm sure.
Well, so before the break, you mentioned genome editing as a way to evaluate for improvement of soybean against drought stress. And in fact, you gave a wonderful 2-hour lecture on genome editing in our joint class and last week. And so tell us about your plans and your current work and your plans for your work with genome editing.
Well, this technique, what it allows is that you can make a precise, specific modification at the DNA in any kind of plant. So we can be much more accurate when we plan to modify something in a way.
Mm-hmm. A very targeted technique in terms of your ability to make changes, specific changes, and where.
Exactly. And not that I think that is important. Sometimes, in my opinion, it doesn't matter exactly where you make the the change, but it matters to most people in the world.
So as a plant scientist, I want to reinforce your point, because I've heard that other very good scientists say it, that it doesn't matter so much where the genetic change is made. So some of the older techniques that introduce genes at random don't particularly worry you.
No, they don't worry me at all. But, okay, this technique has other advantages. It's not only that you can target a specific place in the genome, but you can also, for example, you can repair a mistake in the genome.
Like a mutational error of some sort, right?
Exactly. You can repair it, and that you cannot do with the conventional techniques.
Conventional techniques of transformation, of genetic engineering.
Exactly.
Okay. It's a good point, by the way.
Yes, you can also modify a little bit, for example, the activity of some area in the genome that you cannot do with conventional techniques. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can. It opens much more possibilities with this. However, I think that the big impact of this technique in genetic engineering is the fact that we can somehow simulate what happens normally in nature.
Mm, so that's a good point. Yeah.
So people don't get that stressed about it when they will use it, because most people think that nature doesn't make wrong things. So if we do exactly what nature does, but just faster, then basically we diminish the anxiety that this technology causes on most people in the world.
Yeah. So that's really, really a good point. So with genome editing, we can make very precise, minimal changes, modest changes, what's called targeted mutagenesis in the lingo of scientists. And while introducing a whole gene construct in transformation, it doesn't worry you, and it, for that matter, it doesn't worry me either. Being able to do the very modest targeted changes is sort of a nod to public concerns about transformation, about genetic engineering. That's the way I hear you saying that.
Yes, and that means that that can make a difference if a crop can be commercialized or not, because basically when we do research on an area, we would like it that sometimes what you do of research can be used for someone or something. And most of the research that has come out of the molecular biology labs so far hasn't been applied into agriculture. Mm-hmm. Most of it. Mm-hmm. There's very, very, very little of it.
Yeah.
There's a lot of examples in laboratories that could be very useful, and that could be very useful if they are introduced into normal crops, and they could be available for production, and they are not, because we cannot go through the regulatory issues.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that's a very profound aspect of all this. I think that anybody who studies all the traits that have been created in research programs throughout the world, and so with almost all of them sitting on the shelf, not being used, it does give a person pause, because some of these traits are potentially really valuable to some people, or for environmental protection, for example. And we had a discussion today in class about the regulatory issues, and so we hit it was very fruitful, and the students could see all the requirements that a transgenic crop would have to fulfill in order to be accepted for use in Uruguay. And then when we asked how many of these requirements would be required for a conventionally produced crop, some of them understood already through the course that there were no specific regulatory standards that would apply the way they to a conventionally bred crop that apply to the transgenic crop. So you commented about that. Would you like to make any comment about that aspect of it?
Well, that as a country, a small country with no big companies and that stuff, mm-hmm. Uruguay has no hope on producing and commercializing any kind of transgenic crop that is developed here. We depend completely on the developments that are done in other places that have the possibility of going through these regulatory issues mm-hmm. and paying for it, because it's very, very expensive. Mm. So the only thing that we can do is traditional breeding. Mm. And we are a country that depends 100% in agriculture. Mm-hmm. And we are not, we cannot develop our own crops.
Yeah, genetically engineered crops.
Exactly, yeah. With our own interests, because we can only use those traits that mm-hmm. are interesting for everyone mm-hmm. in the world.
Right. Wow. Yeah. So that's pretty important aspect of all this. You know, Uruguay can develop traits that might be useful here in Uruguay, but because of the regulatory requirements being so extensive, as they are, as we've studied in our class together, it's very hard to imagine that the Uruguayans having enough resources to actually bring them to market.
Exactly, I don't think we have right now.
Yeah,
and I think it's quite general. Most of the laboratories in the world, especially those coming from public institutes, have the same problem. It's not only Uruguay, actually. Yeah. I think in Europe and even in the US, it's only very, very big companies that can afford going through all these regulations.
I think you're right, and so yeah, that's true. I think that university labs can be great incubators for great genetic tools, and but you know, a university lab or a university isn't going to have the tens of millions or more of dollars to do the regulatory, to meet the regulatory requirements, knowing that, of course, conventionally bred crops have no similar system of regulation. So it's a challenge, I think, that anybody who works in this area runs into. You mentioned to me before, you know, as we were talking before the interview, over the course of time, the Uruguay has become a better, maybe a more friendlier, collaborative—that's the word—a collaborative place to work on projects of joint interest. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, I think in the last 10 years it has changed quite a lot. At the beginning of my life as a scientist in mm-hmm. Uruguay, I would say, I think it was much more difficult to talk or to collaborate between people coming from different areas. Nowadays, I think in the last 10 years, I would say, where national agencies for funding also have made a big effort to promote collaboration between different institutes. So, for example, we have a collaboration with a breeding program of soybean and breeders and agronomists, and I am a biologist, and my group, my whole group are biologists or biochemists. And I think what has changed basically from all sides has been the knowledge that we don't know actually much about what we are doing, and we need to complement our knowledge from others. When I started as a working independently as a plant molecular biology, I thought I could explain everything from the molecular point of view. Mm-hmm. And I had no knowledge whatsoever on the producing system and the agriculture by itself. But I thought I had a lot of knowledge.
As we all do sometime in our life, we're all, yeah, this is a very common story.
Yes, but in the last years I have learned a lot about other things that are not molecular biology, and I realized that 90% of the things that I thought they could be really useful, they're useless in real life. So I learned to listen, probably, to listen to other points of view, other points of view. And I think it has been from both sides, because I think the main problem always has been the interaction between breeders and molecular biologists. None of them understood the other part. Mm-hmm. And now I think breeders have acknowledged that molecular biology can help them to improve something. Okay. And we have acknowledged that we don't have the truth of everything that we have to, learn. We have a lot to learn about from them.
Boy, that's great. Yeah, I remember back in 1988 was when I received my PhD, and when I first started working at the university level as a professor, an assistant professor, there was still some evidence of sort of that tension that between molecular biologists and the applied scientists like me and conventional breeders and agronomists. There's all kinds of tensions there, and so you've kind of experienced a diminution of those tensions, and you've kind of shared what was part of it, part of this progress in your own story.
Yes. Probably with a little bit delay in time with respect to the U.S., because here everything comes 10 or 15 years after. It's never at the same time. We are always late. Around 10 or 15 years has been like that, established. And so we still had this tension until not so long ago.
Sure. And I want to highlight a word for listeners that you shared as we sort of prepped a little bit for the interview, and you used the word humildad in Spanish, or humility in English, and
Well, the thing that my life has become easier since I decided to be a little bit more humble about my knowledge, because otherwise I was just not understanding things. So I think everybody has, I don't know everybody, but it has, you notice that people that really know about an area are more humble about what they know. People that don't know about an area, they are much more aggressive about their knowledge, and they think that they really know much more than they do. So the more you know, I think the more you realize that you don't know, probably.
That is exactly what I was going to say. Exactly, yeah. I think that's been my life experience. As I've learned more in my areas of expertise, I've come to respect expertise, from all the people that know all the other fields that I don't know. So yeah, so I really think we really want to second your point about humility. I want to thank you very much, Sabina, for joining us. It's been a pleasure, and and I'm enjoying our class together. It's been a great experience. And thank you for listening to the Talking Biotech podcast. Follow us on Twitter at Talking Biotech. Write a review on iTunes and tell a friend to listen, as your support allows us to deliver more about exciting science to more people. I'm Paul Vincelli, and thank you for listening.
Thank you for listening to the Talking Biotech Podcast. Please send your suggestions for guests, comments, or questions to talkingbiotech@gmail.com. Please write a review on iTunes and recommend this podcast to a friend. More downloads and reviews raise the visibility of this podcast and help us reach a wider audience with science.